I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is actor, screenwriter, director, and producer Bryan Cranston. And now, join Marcy Glazer on stage as she introduces Bryan Cranston.
Bryan Cranston has been working exclusively as an actor since he was 24. But his first big breakout role as Hal, the hapless dad on Malcolm in the Middle, came when he was 41. And it wasn't until he was 51 that he got the role that made him a household name. His portrayal of Walter White on Breaking Bad, which earned him 4 Emmys, and he says made everything that followed possible. He's a Tony Award winner for his brilliant portrayal of LBJ in the Tour de Force All the Way on Broadway, and an Oscar nominee for the title role in the film Trumbo. In his new memoir, A Life in Parts, Bryan takes us from his chaotic childhood right up to his latest triumphs. Before we hear from the actor himself, in conversation tonight with our own Director of Arts and Ideas, Barbara Lane, let's take a look at some of the highlights of Bryan Cranston's career.
I'd cook him one of those. A big one.
One of these? No, this is a volumetric flask. You wouldn't cook in one of these.
Yeah. I do.
No, you don't. A volumetric flask is for general mixing and titration. You wouldn't apply heat to a volumetric flask. That's what a boiling flask is for. Did you learn nothing from my chemistry class?
You clearly don't know who you're talking to, so let me clue you in. I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger. A guy opens his door and gets shot, and you think that of me? No. I am the one who knocks.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bryan Cranston, thank you for coming. We are so delighted to have you here. And I want
to
jump right into this wonderful book, A Life in Parts, and start with the dedication. So for Kyle and Amy, we made it a life worth salvaging. For Robin and Taylor, you made it a life worth living. Robin and Taylor, your wife and daughter. But let's talk about Kyle and Amy and a life worth salvaging, because what I know and what everybody will learn when they read your book is you had kind of a tough childhood.
Yeah, I probably worse than some, but not as bad as others. Challenging. There was, for the first 9 years, it was actually bucolic and wonderful, I thought. We lived in a suburb that was comfortable and had friends. One of my friends is here tonight, Bob Burrell. Everything was nice. We played in Little League, and our mom was in the PTA and made our Halloween costumes and was the team mom and was very active. And my dad and mom were actors, like most people's parents. And it was an interesting, fun life. And then it all got pulled out. You know, it was all ended. My dad went through a crisis, a midlife crisis of epic proportion, I think, and he left the family. I didn't see my dad from when I was about 11 to when I was 22 years old. Never saw him. And my mom was brokenhearted. She lost the love of her life and started to self-medicate with alcohol. And so she was emotionally distant, and my dad was out of the picture. So my brother and I, who were close to the same age, 2 years older, and my sister, 7 years younger, were kind of adrift and trying to figure things out. So that was kind of that that dichotomy of a childhood that I was trying to reconcile with, trying to figure out of where I belonged, who I was, what I was supposed to be doing, without any parental guidance. And so my brother was really my father figure, and it wasn't fair to him. He was only 2 years older, and my sister was, you know, at the time she was so much younger, and I didn't really feel the ability to be able to parent her very well. But she's grown into an unbelievably accomplished woman.
And so you and your brother actually left and went to live with your grandparents in the San Bernardino foothills. And that was tough up there. I mean,
he was this German, hard-nosed, old-world kind of guy who was a retired baker, and he had a gentleman's farm and chickens and some goats and, you know, a half acre of crops and things like that. And so we were expected to work. So two kids from the suburbs of Los Angeles are now, turn the TV off, that's over with, and now you're going to just work on the farm. And it was like, that's horrible. And yet, that year with our parents is one of the most significant years of my life. It really changed things and gave me a different perspective. I learned how to kill chickens, which was horrifying, but a necessary rite of passage as far as my grandfather was concerned. And I got one of my first jobs there, working at my neighbor's egg ranch. There was a lot of chickens. And I actually developed an affinity for the smell of chicken shit. I don't know why.
So you mentioned your brother, and I believe the two of you joined the LAPD Explorers, and you were on your way to becoming a policeman.
A policeman?
A policeman.
Yes, I was.
a cop.
And then I want to be an astronaut. yes, that's true.
A cop.
yes. You remember back in the day when in high school they used to have those career days, and they used to come into the auditorium, and there was the fire department, the police department, the military was always represented for those kids in usually lower income families and areas that were questionable about whether they were going to go to college or could afford college. That was not part of the equation for me for those obvious reasons. And my brother, at the age of 16, for some reason, joined this police explorer group, and he had to go to the LAPD Academy 8 Saturdays in a row to graduate. And then as a group, they kind of, you know, help out the policemen and crowd control and things like that. You learn police procedure. And they travel. And that's why he wanted to do it, because we were poor kids. And the first year he was in, first summer, they went to Hawaii. And that was, he sent me a postcard of a girl in a bikini on the beach. And just a tease. And the second year, they went to Japan. And I thought, okay, that's it. When I'm 16, the moment I'm 16, I'm joining this, what is it called again? I'm joining that so that I can travel. That's what I'm going to do. And so I did. And I had to go to the academy and went to the academy and started learning police procedure and protocols and things like that and marching and drill formation and physical fitness and the whole thing. And I graduated first in my class out of 111 cadets.
Wow.
So all of a sudden I thought, oh, I had no idea I had an aptitude for this thing. Okay, I guess that's what I'll do. So then my plan was to go to a junior college, and if my grades were good enough, which they were, then to transfer to last 2 years to a university before going into the LAPD. And lots of things happened. We did travel. At 16 years old, the whole group of us went to Europe for 5 weeks. And it was great. And I on that trip, I sadly lost my virginity.
So sorry to hear that.
I go back every year to look for it.
There's a great scene in the book. There's a great scene with the chickens, too. But we'll leave that.
We'll leave the chickens. and hookers alone, shall we?
So you mentioned going to college.
16.
Yeah. You mentioned going to college, and in college is where you took your first acting class. And there's a scene you describe, again in the book, where there was a kiss. And that kiss is responsible probably for you sitting here today, because that's where the light bulb went off for you about acting.
Yes, it was a light bulb that went off.
I am the straight person here today.
We'll just,
for sure.
We'll just speak in euphemism all night long. My counselor said, look, if you want to transfer to a university, they're going to have to see a well-rounded education. You can't take all your primary courses all the time. I didn't know any different. So, okay, take an elective course, acting and stagecraft. Okay, that, I did some acting when I was young. I did a couple commercials and things and some plays at school. And it was fun. I remembered it. So I got into class, and the teacher gathered us all, and we're all kind of crammed in there. And just by virtue of proximity, that was your reading partner. You two read this, you two read this, you two read this. And I get this piece of paper, and I'm nervous, and I'm looking at it. And I look down at the scene, and it says, a couple is making out on a park bench. And I look over, and the girl who got the other side of this didn't quite look at her pages yet. And I thought, oh, no, okay. Okay, so I have to appear that, you know, that she's going to want to kiss me in this scene. So like the male species in the wild, I started, you know, in our own way. You know, like you see those birds, you know, they're going like, I just kind of, you know, struck a pose, lift up the chest a little bit, you know, try to look nonchalant, and then when her eyes came over, it looked away, you know. So in this scene, this couple is making out, and the boy, in this case, has to break up from the embrace and say, Beth, we need to talk. All right, about their relationship. She's all into the guy. The guy is breaking up. So we're finally called up. I put my sides on the floor, and before I can turn, whap! She's on me. I mean, she is kissing me. She puts her whole body on top of mine. I'm like, oh my God. And we're kissing, and we're rolling, and kissing, and kissing, and kissing. And then I feel this on my upstage thigh, like this. And I there was kissing and tapping and kissing and tapping. I was like, and kissing more and tapping and rubbing and rubbing. And finally I realized what she was doing. As she was saying, I have the first line. Let's get on with the scene. Get on with the scene. And I was like, oh, yes. Okay. Beth, we need to talk, you know. But we can kiss some more and then talk if that's, you know. So we finally got through it, and I thought, wow. I'm 19. She's all over me. She likes me a lot. So I go up to her during the break and I say, hey, that went pretty well. And she says, it was a little rough in the beginning. And I go, yeah, well, sorry about it. I said, we should go to lunch. And she looked at me like I was a lost puppy and said, oh, no. No, no, no. I have a boyfriend. And to which any 19-year-old male response at that time was feigning indifference, right? So you go, it's okay. Sure. I got on. She walks away and is like, oh. But two things were spinning in my mind. It was like the first was my job at this moment in this class was to kiss this really attractive woman and make out with her. That was my responsibility. Like, what a great job. The second was I really believed she was into me and we could go out on a date, and she wasn't at all. She was, in fact, not into me. She was acting. And that just started spinning my head around. I couldn't figure out what was up or down. I was hyperventilating. I was sweaty. I don't know. And I didn't even know. I wish I knew what happened to Meryl Streep later on, but I hope she's well, you know. No, that was it. And I realized, okay, that's the end of police work. I can't do that. I didn't continue after the 2 years.
One of the things that's really clear reading this book is what a hardworking actor you always have been, and how you prepare, and just how diligent you are about the craft. And one of my favorite stories was the Mars Bar commercial that you did, where you had to very quickly learn how to rappel down a mountain. Yeah. Tell us how that came about.
Well, I lied. You go on an audition and they want to know, do you rappel off a mountain? Can you mountain climb? I go, mountain climb? You like hike? No. I like rappelling with the ropes off the mountain. I have never done that. I've never really wanted to do that. And so, of course, I went to the audition and said, I'm an expert at it. Of course I, oh yeah. Oh, we used to go up to, my family and I used to go up to Mount Shasta all the time where you have some good, we used to do it all the time. And then we'd come home, but locally was, you know, the rappelling isn't as good, you know. You get a sense when you go on an audition, it felt like, I think I could get a callback to this. And they said, during the callback, we're going to ask you to rappel off the three-story building next door. How do you feel about that? Of course, to which I said, can we do it now? Knowing full well it's an empty boast. They didn't have it set up. There was no way that was going to happen. We can't do it now? Oh. So I thought, if I better learn this. So I called a company called A16. I don't know if they still exist. They still exist? Yeah, A16. And it's an outdoor company. And I said, I need to learn how to do this. And there was a guy named Chad who said, dude, you got me, man. I totally know how to do this. And I was like, is there anyone else there who might know how to do this? No, dude, I'm your guy, man. I'm your guy. It's like, okay. He told me to meet him at the Chatsworth Rocks, very close to my boyhood home. And he'll bring all the equipment. We'll have one session of maybe 4 to 5 hours. Okay. And I told him when we got there, I need to learn all the jargon. I know I want to learn all these names for everything, right? And there was a huge rock, maybe 30 feet tall, big boulder. And we walked around the back of it, got up to the top. He tied it off, and he went down. He showed me how to do it. Then it was my turn. He hooked me up. And he said, you want to come perpendicular to it, right? And so I come off the face of the rock, and I can't. I'm stuck like this. And he says, take your right hand and put it behind your back. And it's like, okay, Chad. And I'm standing there on the face of the rock, and I'm going, okay. He goes, dude, take your right, okay. And I'm... And I actually looked at my right hand and went, why aren't you moving? And it's like, it's almost like it didn't want to go. And it was like, I was petrified. I was so scared that my whole insides was stuck and caught and cramped and twisted. And I finally let myself down this along the face, you know, as I'm going down. He says, that was awful, man. And okay. Finally had the courage to put the hand behind, and I'm coming down the rock, you know, scaling it down this way, walking down, and it was actually okay. And I did it another time and another time. By the sixth or seventh time, I was jumping. By the tenth time, I was doing 360s. It was actually extremely fun. It was so much fun. So I do get the call back. I go to the place. There's five guys who are auditioning. And the first two guys were terrible and doing like one of the first times I was going down. And the producers were scared because this is for Mars candy bars. You want a guy jumping down and going, "Hey, California lifestyle." Yeah. You know? You know, that's you too can have it. Mars bars.
You're listening to actor, screenwriter, director, and producer Bryan Cranston, whose new memoir is A Life in Parts on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So I knew they wanted something exciting. So I said to the producers, "Is it okay if I see that you're using a double gold line through the carabiner?" "It's causing too much friction. Do you mind if I go with a single line through that carabiner?" "It's kind of like packing your own chute." "No, go ahead. So I go up to the top. They had a professional stuntman up there. And he hooked me up. I said, "The single line. You sure?" Yeah, single line. I'm like, "Whoa." I go up to the parapet wall. "You guys ready?" "All right." "Okay, here I come." And I just jumped off the back and wham, right into the middle of the building, did a little turnaround and down. It goes, yeah, it wasn't bad. And I got the role. So... a week later, we happened to be shooting at the Chatsworth Rocks, right there. And I couldn't help but telling the producers, "You're not going to believe this. This is the exact spot where I first learned how to do it." First time. This was it.
Well, talking about hard work, you honed your craft on a soap opera, Loving, and you talked to lots of actors who started in soaps, and they often tell you how much they learned and the discipline and what working on a soap meant for their career. And so many people speak lightly of that work, but that was really important to you. You learned a lot.
God, it was the quantity of material is just overwhelming. Every time you memorize a script, you pound it into your brain, and then you do it, and then you throw that away, and you got another one. So it wasn't so much the quality. It was just figuring out how to find honest moments in all this mountain of material that you've got to filter through. And they had this whole idea of they knew how many people were watching per week, like 2.5 times per week or something. So you would always do a 2 steps forward, 1 step back, kind of in the delivery. So you always thought you were repeating dialogue. "Remember what I told you yesterday, Rebecca?" Yeah. "Jonah is not my real son." You know, it's like, and there's a little bird going, "Wait a minute, you just said this." And I go, "I know, I said it yesterday, but it's a little different." So it was very tough to be able to have some honest moments in that. And anybody who can do that really well is really terrific. I mean, and I met some really wonderful actors doing it.
Well, your wife, Robin, is with you here tonight, mm-hmm. and we're so happy to have her. And I mentioned to you that we had Jeff Bridges here recently,
yeah.
who has a 40-year-long marriage, and you and Robin have been together, and it just is so inspiring because when you read People magazine, that hardly ever happens.
Is that right? Yeah.
But you two met on Airwolf, where you played a bad guy hijacker,
yeah.
and I believe you actually held her hostage.
I did. As a hijacker has wont to do. This was a horrible... Do you remember the show, Airwolf? Terrible, terrible show. I bet some of you do remember, but you're not even going to raise your hand or admit that you ever watched that terrible show. It starred Jan Michael Vincent and Ernest Borgnine and a helicopter. Can you imagine being a writer on that show? Come up with another storyline involving a helicopter. It was tough. And so back in those days, if you were a series regular, you were always a good guy. And the guest stars were either bad guys or victims. So and usually followed right along the gender line. So I was the bad guy, and Robin and a few other women on the show were these victims at a reunion of a sorority. And I took them. This is very serious. I don't kid about Airwolf. And I held them captive and threatened to kill them. And I met Robin, and she was beautiful and funny and had a boyfriend. And wait, what? Had a boyfriend. And I had a girlfriend. So it was actually a blessing because we were able to flirt and have fun with each other and get to know each other without having that tension of, ooh, are you going to make a move? Or, you know, it wasn't going to happen. So, and then a year later, we were in the same comedy improv class. And we had a moment, as actors do every week. You greet each other. We're very intimate people, and we kiss and we hug, and you know. And we kissed each other's lips, and we stayed too long. And neither one of us planned this, but we, you know, there's a duration. I don't know if you know this, Barbara.
Probably not.
There is a proper duration of a friend-to-friend kiss.
Okay, how long is it?
I'll show you.
Come on.
Okay. Right?
Show me the other one.
Okay. Okay. Ready? Okay. No.
Robin, I understand completely.
So
I'm dying.
Oh, thank you. And you're a good kisser.
I opened my mouth a little. Did you get
that? Yeah, I did. The secret to good kissing is always never have a closed mouth. You have to open your mouth a little bit to enjoy the lips.
Oh, I'm sweating. I want to jump ahead to Malcolm in the Middle. And the mother, so brilliantly played by Jane Kaczmarek, was the main character. And actually, the character of Hal was underwritten when you first read it. It wasn't a fully developed character. Yeah. So how did you build the character of Hal?
It was a brilliantly written script by Linwood Boomer, I didn't know what to do. My character had 5 lines in the pilot episode, and I didn't really know. They were having trouble casting this role. Everyone else was cast except the dad, and they were shooting soon. So I went in there and I thought about who is this guy, because the mom and Malcolm are so overpowering, especially the mom is so overpowering. I just started to write down all her attributes, you know, fearless sergeant of arms, you know, the mother lion, you know, this. Afraid of nothing, you know. I mean, all these things, and then I thought, well, what's the opposite of that? All right, so he's afraid of everything, you know. He's more sensitive. He's softer. He's, you know, he's romantic. He's worried about being a dad, a husband, losing his job, perhaps. So all these things started to come to, and I realized what I was doing. I was creating this character to complement the. You know, how greatly written she was. And it seemed to work. So I came in, and that's what I presented to try to present a character who was distracted by his family, not disinterested. Mm-hmm. I wanted to make that distinction.
Right. And there's so many memorable moments. The dancing in the Tidy Whiteys is one of my favorites. But in the book, you describe, and this sort of reminds me of the repelling scene. There's a through line in your work, the live bee scene. Yeah. Can you talk about that? And I mean, that was painful, actually.
Yeah, I had 75,000 honeybees on me from my waist to my head. It was almost like wearing chainmail. And Linwood Boomer came to me and said, what do you think about wearing bees? I said, yeah, sounds cool. He goes, okay, thank you. We just want to know if you would do it. So they came up with the image first, and then they planned the whole, they went back to the beginning. They reverse engineered it and came up with a storyline to justify how this would come to be. And on the day, they taped my wrists, my long sleeve, and they taped this down. They put cotton in my ears, and they didn't have to do my nose because they took a repellent, an insect repellent, and put it on my face because they wanted to see my face. So I was completely covered except for this little circle on my face. And I really knew that I was going to have to be very calm and serene so that I wouldn't panic and fall down, because that would be a bad thing. Bees only land on a person if they think it's a flower or if they're tired. So I had a good relationship with bees. My grandfather had some hives on his farm, so that was fun. But they would squirt the pheromones, the queen's pheromones from that particular hive, all over me, on my head, everywhere. They're squirting with a little eyedropper, right? And then they open up the hive, and they help gently scoop out some bees with a little dustpan, and they put it here in my waist, and they just start crawling up, you know, and they're just all over. So I found it fascinating. And actually, I didn't have to calm myself down, because the energy of 75,000 bees moving was a vibration. It was warm, and there was that white noise of the bzzz. It was almost like you're sitting in a Brookstone chair. You know, like. Now I had to worry about, I didn't want to drop, because a bee will sting you. Anatomically, they're designed that if you touch it, the bee's tail comes up and hits. That's why you can get stung by a dead bee, because it just happens. Mm. So they're not aggressive at all, unless you're actually near the hive, near the queen bee. But they left the queen bee back at home. I was there with all these bees standing like this, and I all of a sudden felt a little pinch, and I went, I think I got stung. Now, when you're wearing 75,000 bees, what I realized is that the biggest pain when you get stung is the surprise factor, because it was like, oh, that was like just a little prick. And the beekeeper comes, where is it? He's out ready to flick it away. And I go, in my scrotum. To which he goes, sorry, man. A bee wandered down there, and I turned, and it was like I pressed against him, and bing. But it was a weird experience. But I did a bunch of weird experiences on that show. I loved it.
Well, we loved it too. And we're going to move up to what everybody wants to hear about, which is Breaking Bad. But I have to mention that you did a role. You played Patrick Crump on The X-Files, who was a loathsome character. That show was written by Vince Gilligan. And Vince Gilligan, we happen to know because he was here on this stage several years ago, fought for you to play Walter White in Breaking Bad. And actually, we have a clip of Vince Gilligan talking about why he chose you to play Walter White. So if we could roll that clip now, we'll hear from Vince Gilligan.
I was very lucky. I get a lot of credit for thinking outside of the box and thinking about Bryan Cranston, who everyone knew as Hal, the goofy dad, and Malcolm in the Middle. But I was not that insightful because I had been lucky on The X-Files. 18 months before Malcolm in the Middle ever existed, I wrote an episode of The X-Files in which we needed a character. We had a two-hander. It was basically Agent Mulder stuck in a car with this creep, this really unpleasant guy who's an anti-Semite and a nasty guy and a hillbilly peckerwood idiot. And you really don't like this guy, and he's dangerous, and he's holding a gun to Mulder's head the whole time. And yet, spoiler alert, of course this was like 13 years ago, but at the end of the hour, he dies, and when he dies, it's, I don't know if it's imperative, but it's important to me, it was important to me that you felt bad for the guy. And it was tough. We had a lot of actors come in who could be menacing and creepy and scary, but the whole package of creepy and scary and menacing and yet containing some kernel of humanity that shone through even in their nastiest moments where you nonetheless felt bad for them, you were able to sympathize on some level. We were in trouble until Bryan Cranston walked in, and I'd never laid eyes on him before, never heard of him before, and he nailed it. And of course, I realized later I had seen him before, but he's such a chameleon I hadn't realized it, but I realized he was the one-armed officer who sends Tom Hanks on his mission in Saving Private Ryan, and I realized he was the funny dentist, Seinfeld's funny dentist in Seinfeld, and he was Buzz Aldrin and From the Earth to the Moon and all these things. And he was scary, and he was everything we needed. He was brilliant in that episode. And about a year and a half later, I'm watching a commercial for this new show called Malcolm in the Middle, and I say, and it takes me a while because he's such a chameleon, but I say, this guy, there's something about this guy. Oh, my God, it's that guy. It's Bryan Cranston. I didn't know he could be funny. I had no idea. And so when I went to the AMC, I said, you know, can we, I want to hire this guy. He's who I thought of when I was writing it. And they all they knew was Malcolm in the Middle, and they said, you're crazy. That's, you know. But then I showed them, luckily I showed them, sent them a DVD of that episode, and they said, ooh, okay, all right, okay. So I do not feel in the least that I was particularly insightful. I just knew him for what he was capable of. And my first impression, and as we all know, first impressions are hard to break. My first impression of him was as an intensely dramatic actor. So.
That's sweet. If I could just pause a second on Vince, what was so brilliant about him in that little episode that I did was that normally writers would have written my character to be sympathetic. They would have written that so that the lead character would be encouraged by the audience to save this guy. Oh yeah, come on, Mulder. He's a nice guy. Save him. But you're not as invested. So what he did was create this character to be a despicable person, which put the emotional dilemma in the core of his central character. Do I try to save this person simply because he's a human being? That is what makes the people lean in. And that was my first indication of the nuance of Vince Gilligan and why when I read the pilot for Breaking Bad, it was all over that and where he was going to go with it. So it was a no-brainer as far as I was concerned.
So Vince Gilligan famously tells you about Walter White, I want to take this character from Mr. Chips to Scarface. And that's what you say in your book, and I'll ask you to read a little bit about this,
is
the seeds for that transformation were actually sown in the very first episode. And if you want to start right down here.
Start here?
Yeah.
For me, Walter's moral decay doesn't begin when he watches Jane die. Killing Mike, Walter's one-time partner, doesn't mark a turning point either. For me, the seed was sown in the very first episode. Walter is dealt a bad hand. He's been living inside a kind of emotional dead zone and faced with a definitive prognosis, 2 years to live. Feelings burst from his core, fear, anger, desperation. As time wears on, those initial feelings burn off and leave a toxic residue, a sludge that allows him to act with recklessness and hubris, to compromise everything he holds dear, to endanger the people he loves most, his family. Character is both formed and revealed when we are tested, when we are forced to make decisions under pressure. That test can either make us stronger or it can highlight our weaknesses and crack us into pieces. Walter fails the test. I understand why. Temptation, humiliation, wanting to feel like he really lived, like he had really been the man, and a desire to go out on his terms, to control his own destiny. But for whatever reasons, he fails. The question for the show and the challenge for me as an actor was, how do we legitimize Walt's trajectory, make it believable and relatable? Walt couldn't suddenly go from meek depressive to heartless bastard who happened to poison a little boy. The answer was to go slowly. We had to move with consideration. We had to sequence carefully. We had to take baby steps. That's what serialized television was perfect for, the perfect format for the show. In a movie, we would have been forced to take great leaps, compress time, and truncate storylines. That cramming would have strained credulity. An audience would have rejected it.
Yeah. Walter White, yeah.
This is Bina, KALW's series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features actor, screenwriter, director, and producer Bryan Cranston, whose new memoir is A Life in Parts. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Such an incredible character, such an incredible portrayal. We couldn't stop watching. I think for many people, the whole idea of binge watching began with Breaking Bad. You just couldn't turn away.
Yeah, yeah. It became as addictive as the drug he was making, really.
It did. Yeah. And one of the scenes, and there's so many memorable scenes, but I know that one of the ones that was the most difficult for you is the scene when Jesse is in bed with Jane.
Yeah.
And Jane dies, chokes on her own vomit.
Yeah.
And you had a very personal reaction to that scene. So can you tell us about that?
You know, when I prepare to do an emotional scene like that, I write out in longhand different ideas or thoughts of possibilities of where it could go emotionally. And I just sort of stream of consciousness write these out. And then I look at it and read it through, and now it's in my mind as I read through the scene again and again. And then I let it go, allowing for the memory bank to be able to call upon that when I need it. But you don't want to be thinking of that when you're actually doing the scene. You don't want to be saying, okay, here comes remorse. Yeah. And next followed by grief. So if after the end of a take, the director and you feel like, oh, there's more I think we can get out of that, then you just do another take. And you kind of think about what else, where it could go. But you never want it to plan it out too specifically, because then it gets too by rote. And you want to leave it organic and honest. That's why we do so many takes, to make sure that you get a variety of different reactions and emotions. And then in editing, in the edit process, then you decide what works best. In that particular time, I wrote down so many things. And Kristen Ritter, a beautiful actor, and she was giving her all, choking off screen as the camera is on me. And I'm going through a bunch of different things, hard to remember when you're going through it because it's so ephemeral. And one of the things that I remember writing down, only in retrospect, was reasons to save her or reasons to let her die. I was making another list. And one of the reasons to save her was she's just a young girl, and she could be my daughter, is what I wrote, you know. She's someone's daughter. And during one of the takes, as I'm witnessing the horror of watching a person die and an act of omission on my part, and going through, you know, the synapses are snapping of what should I do, don't do it, save her, don't save her. You know, she was going to blow our whole enterprise, and she's probably going to kill Jesse anyway because she's a heroin addict, and all these things are in your mind, in your body. And one of them that came was Kristen Ritter's face in almost like a moment of hallucinogenic drug experience. Her face just disappeared. and it was replaced with the face of my real daughter. And I was watching my real daughter choke to death on her own vomit, and it's like, it's the worst thing you can imagine for a parent. And so I cannot recall the story again without feeling a little heaviness in my chest, because it comes back, and because I had that experience and I saw her face and I saw her dying in front of me and then had that reaction, and then that went away and something else happened and something else came in. But afterward, I was a mess. And fortunately, you get so intimate with your castmates, they become a family. And Michael Slovis, who was our director of photography, and came over and was hugging me, and I'm weeping, and Anna Gunn plays Skyler and is holding me. And you know, it's just the emotional journey of an actor, that you got to be willing to have those moments of unpredictability and suffering to a point. You're risking, emotional risk is at stake, and you have to be willing to go there. Mm.
You know, much the way you created Hal, who was such a different character, you describe how you sank into Walter White. You gained weight. You dressed badly. His whole, what he wore, actually, you brought that to the role. Do you want to talk about how you created him sort of from the inside out?
Yeah, without the power, the transformative power of that script, it's just like when you read a good novel and you can't wait to get back to bed to read the next chapter, and you debate, should I read another chapter? And it sends you off. It allows you to daydream or to imagine the art direction in your mind about the setting of that good book. Same thing when you read a good script. From an actor's standpoint, because we're charged with then creating the character and making him from two-dimensional to three-dimensional, you start opening up and allowing all these impulses to come in. And when I had my first meeting with Vince, his writing was so pure and so evocative that I went in and I told him, I said, you know, he should be overweight. He should have gone to seed. He has hair that's, you don't see any color to it. He has no color to his face. I would take the color out of my face. I would have a hair that always needs a haircut. I would have a mustache that people would look at and go, why bother? My clothes should all be in colors of taupe and sand and all the colors that, and light yellow maybe, and that blend into the wall. He was invisible to himself and to society. And I said he should be overweight. And, you know, and I was telling him this. But it was also a way of me to take ownership. You know, to let him know, I got this. Mm. If you want to give this to me, if you want to offer this to me, then let me take it, and I'll take good care of him, and I got it. I'll take it the rest of the way, and I'll blow it up. You know, so for sure, my first meeting with Vince, I was in there I was after it. Mm. I wanted that role, and I was lifting my leg on him and marking him everywhere I could.
and the tidy whities.
And tidy whities. Tidy whities. I asked him, I said, why the tidy whities? He goes, as you say, you know, he's a good gentleman from Virginia. And I just thought it looked kind of funny. But I said, I wore tidy whities for 7 years on Malcolm in the Middle. And he goes, oh, okay, well, go ahead and change it. And I thought about it, and I thought, well, I chose the tidy whities on Malcolm because he was just a big boy. And it was funny. But there was a reason, there must have been a reason that Vince wrote tidy whities in that first episode. And so I thought, why? And then it made sense to me that he was stunted. His growth was stunted. He didn't care. At a certain point, he just stopped caring. And I think I wanted to have his physicality manifest that lack of caring. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, then this grown man wearing tidy whities is pathetic. Yeah. You know, so.
I just want to acknowledge the LBJ role, because you say you had to let Walter White die, and the vehicle was playing LBJ in the play all the way on Broadway, which was so outstanding. I feel so lucky to have seen it. The first years of his presidency when he was trying to pass the Civil Rights Act of 1964. I'm sure that you probably have some reflections on the way that politics were played in LBJ's time and what we're looking at today.
How coy.
Well, we've kissed.
Yeah. Yeah. I see what you mean. We can drop the pretense. It was an absolute joy. I knew about a year and a half before we knew the ending of Breaking Bad and what had become of the show, and the character of Walter White was bigger and more unwieldy than I could. It was going to crush me if I tried to get in there and try to manage it somehow. So I knew just instinctively that I didn't and shouldn't be on television for at least 3 years. I don't know why 3 years came to me, but it did. And so I thought, I want to be able to continue doing what I love to do. So I think I need to change mediums now and look for a play. And they found this play, All the Way, written by Robert Shankin. And a phenomenal story, and the character is unbelievable. In fact, Bill Moyers, the famed journalist who was a speechwriter and then a press secretary for LBJ, said, 11 of the most interesting people I've ever known is LBJ. He told me, he said, when he would go to the White House and put his hand on the doorknob to the Oval Office, he would take a deep inhale and exhale because he never knew which Lyndon Johnson was going to be on the other side of that door. He was that mercurial. And you had to manage it. High highs of ambition and incredible low insecurities. Mm. And so it's tragic and heroic. It's Shakespearean. And so it was a huge thing to grab, and I was excited to do it. It was in learning a lot about him and his ability you know, what most people do remember of him, or his legacy has been, up until recently, was that of a failed president because of Vietnam. Yeah. And he owns that. I mean, that is his. But what is also fair is then to look back and not to reinvent history, but to reexamine history and realize the tremendous achievements that he made domestically, mm-hmm. Built a foundation of how we should and do live, to the most part. And I really came to respect them. And one of the things as an actor is that you never want to get into a position of judging your character. So whatever preconceived ideas I had about LBJ had to go. So I had to look out through his eyes, not into him. So that was the challenge. What I learned about him was that he had an unbelievable political acumen. He also had an unbelievable political hubris, and I think that's what created the downfall in Vietnam, is that listening to McNamara and trying to gauge it, he didn't have a lot of interest in foreign affairs to begin with, and there were indications through the books I read, through all the Robert Caro books and things, that he hoped that every advance and movement in the theater of Vietnam would be the end of it, mm-hmm. and he was told it. Yes, this is going to do it. This is going to end it. Okay, let's do it. And it, of course, it didn't. And then but this one will. And it didn't. And he was too far in. And that's why I believe he didn't run. So in March 31st of 1968, he said, "I will not accept the nomination of my party," And he thought, someone else needs to handle this because I clearly can't. Now, how does that relate to now? Well, he was a guy who knew how to be diplomatic. He knew it was a horse dealing. That's the art of politics. He was in the House of Representatives for 12 years, then in the Senate for 12 years, then the vice president, then the presidency. He knew all the players. He knew what they wanted. Back in his day, this historians will all agree to this, they would always associate with each other. It was very, very common for both sides of the aisle to go to dinner, to know the spouses, to know the kids, to party, to have drinks together. If you do that, if you break bread with someone, the next day when you have to hammer out a deal and you are on opposite sides, my inclination is to not throw you under the bus, but to go, Barbara, we've got to figure this out. We've got to make this work. Not to go, you are destroying the country and I'm not budging. What we have now is a bastardization of democracy, in my view, is that, is well, you'll probably want to hear it first. It is that we've taken our politics and made it a sport to where if someone has a great idea that would help our country, help our society, but they happen to be on the other side of the party line, we can't support that. It's ridiculous. It's as if a Republican or a Democrat, whatever side of the aisle you are on, has a good idea, you cannot cooperate. As if they win, I lose. And that's, we got to get away from that mentality. Mm-hmm. That's not it. And I from what I've gleaned from his autobiography and all the people who know him and his daughters and all the people whom I met who knew him very well, he would be shocked and appalled and greatly saddened by the display of what's going on in this election. It is sad. It makes me feel that we are not operating at our best. Yeah. We are better humans than this, and we need to lift the conversation to a level of civility and kindness and respect that we're just not seeing.
Well, thank you all so much for being here tonight. Bryan Cranston, most of all, thanks to you. It's a wonderful book. Best of luck to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was actor, screenwriter, director, and producer Bryan Cranston, whose new memoir is A Life in Parts. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Bernardi, Maya Finley, and Alex Espolay. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.